Good morning. On today's program, while a small number of European nations have already decided to join US President Donald Trump's controversial Board of Peace, others are still mulling it over. And, 1 year on from the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, the daily life of many Syrian people remains shaped by hardship. First, we go to Australia, where on Thursday the country held a national day of mourning for the victims of the terrorist attack at Bondi Beach. 15 people were killed when gunmen opened fire at a Jewish festival on a warm summer's evening on the 14th of December. This week, the Parliament in Canberra voted for sweeping gun law reforms and tougher action on hate speech. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
National days of mourning in Australia are rare. On Thursday, the nation paused to remember one of its worst mass shootings in three decades. The attack at Bondi Beach in December shattered Australia's sense of isolation from global insecurity. No longer was it protected by its geography. The government in Canberra said the atrocity was an act of terrorism against Jewish people, perpetrated by gunmen who'd been contaminated by the ideology of the Islamic State group. Flags across the country flew at half-mast and prominent buildings were illuminated. Australians were encouraged to leave a candle on their doorstep to remember the mass shooting at a Jewish festival of light. They were also invited to undertake an act of kindness, compassion or charity to promote goodwill. At one event in Sydney, children came together to cook meals for the needy. At a memorial service at the Sydney Opera House, the families of each of the 15 victims lit a candle in their honour. The youngest was a 10-year-old girl called Matilda. The oldest, who'd lived through the Holocaust, was 87. A minute's silence was observed. The courage of bystanders who ran into the line of fire to help the victims was also recognised. One of the heroes of Bondi attended the event at the Opera House. Ahmed Al-Ahmed was the man who famously disarmed one of the gunmen. His bravery was captured on mobile phone footage. It shows the Syrian migrant hiding behind a parked car before choosing his moment to rush the older attacker, wrenching his rifle away. Ahmed's actions almost certainly saved lives. He was shot and wounded. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the day of mourning was his country's opportunity to wrap its arms around the Jewish community. He apologised for not protecting it from harm. After the attack at Bondi, Mr. Albanese was accused of not doing enough to curb rising anti-Semitism in Australia in recent years. The atrocity was allegedly carried out by a father and his son. The older man was shot dead by the police. His 24-year-old son has been charged with almost 60 crimes, including 15 counts of murder and a terrorism offence. The political reaction to the tragedy has been swift. This week, the Parliament in Canberra voted for sweeping gun law reforms and tougher action on hate speech. Naveed Akram, the sole surviving alleged gunman, is due back in court in April. Australian police believe the pair acted alone. It's alleged they filmed themselves firing high-powered weapons in the weeks before the massacre at a remote property in New South Wales. Soon, a Royal Commission, Australia's highest form of independent inquiry, will start to investigate anti-Semitism and social cohesion following the atrocity at Bondi Beach. A senior government minister said the attackers came with hate in their hearts and guns in their hands. On Australia's day of mourning, the message was clear. Light will triumph over darkness. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
To Europe next, where a small number of countries agreed to join US President Donald Trump's Board of Peace this week, although far fewer perhaps than he would have hoped. Albania, Belarus and Kosovo, as well as two European Union members, Bulgaria and Hungary, have either joined or agreed to join the initiative, which President Trump said would help resolve global conflicts. Others are still mulling the idea. From the Czech capital Prague, Rob Cameron has this report.
The Board of Peace was launched with great fanfare this week at Davos. 19 leaders or national representatives joined the US president on stage for the signing ceremony. They stood in front of a backdrop featuring the new organization's logo, which is virtually identical to the UN's logo, but in Trump's favorite gold and an image of North America instead of the world. As ever with the US president, details are thin, and it's unclear which conflicts the board has been set up to address. UN Security Council Resolution 2803, adopted on the 17th of November, supported the overall Gaza peace plan put forward by the US and endorsed the creation of an international stabilization framework that did indeed include a role for what is now referred to as the Board of Peace. But the board's founding charter, obtained and published in full this week by the Times of Israel and others, makes no mention of Gaza, merely areas affected or threatened by conflict. Others have pointed out that any binding international agreement that creates legal obligations for the United States has to receive congressional approval. Any funding, troop deployment, or reconstruction has to be approved by both houses of Congress. Membership lasts 3 years unless you stump up $1 billion, but where does that money go? It also appears the chairman of the board will be one Donald J. Trump. Unsurprisingly, most countries, including the rest of the G7, have either flatly rejected the proposal or are politely studying the leaflet. Those European countries that have signed up, especially Albania and tiny Kosovo, were evidently swayed by the prospect of scoring brownie points with the capricious leader of the free world. They appeared unconcerned at sitting at the same table as such titans of democracy and the rule of law as Belarus, Uzbekistan, and the UAE. Here in Prague, Czech officials have confirmed they did receive an invitation and are currently studying it. Petr Matzinka, the country's foreign minister, has been given the task of preparing a position for the cabinet to make a decision. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is in a tricky spot. A fellow populist and also a billionaire, he is enamoured with Mr. Trump. He even wears the same red baseball cap emblazoned with a Czech phrase. But he also wants to preserve the respect of his European counterparts now he has returned to the post of Prime Minister. There's been much backslapping of Emmanuel Macron at EU summits, and he presented Ursula von der Leyen with a bouquet of flowers. And pity the Slovaks. Prime Minister Robert Fico was in Mar-a-Lago recently, doing the thumbs up with the Donald and announcing a new era of cooperation with America in nuclear technology. It was a triumph for his carefully curated brand of diplomacy aimed at all four cardinal points of the compass. But it's unclear Slovakia has even received an invitation to join the board. Mr. Fico's right-hand man, Defence Minister Robert Kaliniak, said he couldn't possibly comment. The head of Fico's coalition partner, the nationalist Slovak National Party, said as far as he was aware, the Slovaks hadn't been invited. And anyway, he said, he wasn't sure his country should be standing side by side with Mr. Trump. That may change, but Slovakia, the Czech Republic and several other European countries are still weighing up their options. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
And finally to Syria, where 1 year on from the fall of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the new government of Ahmed al-Sharaa is struggling to revive the decimated economy after decades of civil war and sanctions. In Damascus, daily life remains shaped by hardship, with power cuts, unreliable water supplies, and long queues outside bakeries for bread. Meanwhile, in the northeast, the semi-autonomous Kurdish community, who have long desired an independent state, face an uncertain future as the government in Damascus vows to govern a unified Syria. Hannah McCarthy has this report.
It had been a year since I drove through the Bekaa Valley and arrived at Masna, the land crossing that serves as the main gateway between Lebanon and Syria. When I passed through a year ago, Syrian officials were just returning to their offices, somewhat shell-shocked and dazed after deserting them during the fall of the Assad regime. Decades of brutal dictatorship fell under pressure from a lightning offensive overseen by the forces of Ahmed al-Sharaa, the Islamist militant who has transitioned quickly to Syrian statesman. The land crossing today involves several stops and questions by young Syrian soldiers who only recently fought as rebels under al-Shara. Alongside the usual questions of who you are and what are you doing is the cost of the visa, which varies from $400 to nothing. The high visa prices are designed both to discourage foreign fighters from Iraq and Iran, while also providing the government with much-needed revenue as it attempts to revive the decimated Syrian economy after decades of civil war and sanctions. In Damascus, daily life remains shaped by hardship. Power cuts are long, water supplies are unreliable, and there are still long and anxious queues outside the bakeries providing the cheap subsidised flatbread that hungry Syrian families rely on. The boundaries of social freedoms under the new government, while broader in many respects than under Assad, also remain uncertain. No one is drinking alcohol when I visit Naranj, the upmarket restaurant in old Damascus, which was often frequented by Bashar al-Assad before he fled to Moscow in December 2024. Across major Syrian cities, nightclubs and music venues have been shut and alcohol sales restricted, while anyone bringing a bottle of wine in their luggage is liable to have it seized at the airport and fined. While Syrian officials insist there is no formal ban on alcohol, many Syrians, particularly those from the Christian minority, see these moves as evidence of a creeping moral crackdown led by Islamist factions within the ruling government. But for many conservative Sunni Muslims who have returned from exile in places like Idlib, they say they have more freedom to practice their faith than under the Assad regime. But many of Syria's minorities remain uncertain both about their security under al-Shara's government and their country's prospects for economic recovery. In the heartlands of the Alawite community, around the port city of Latakia, human rights groups documented attacks by government forces against Alawites who fear they are being collectively punished for their association with the old Assad regime. Further south in the Druze stronghold of Sweida, protests have flared against what residents describe as heavy-handed security tactics and political marginalisation. Local Druze leaders have, in some cases, formed security relationships with Israel, which has for years spoken of a breakaway Druze statelet that would form a buffer between the Jewish state and Syria. Meanwhile, in Syria's northeast, the semi-autonomous Kurdish community, who have long desired an independent state, face an uncertain future as the government in Damascus vows to govern a unified Syria. When the Syrian state fractured amid civil war, the Kurdish-Syrian Democratic Forces began governing the northeastern part of the country as a semi-autonomous region, including many Arab-majority areas. Despite their name, the Syrian Democratic Forces often governed along authoritarian lines, while enjoying US backing in return for fighting forces from the so-called Islamic State that seized large swaths of Syria during the civil war. In recent weeks, negotiations between Damascus and the Syrian Kurds have broken down as al-Shara lost patience with Kurdish demands for security guarantees and their failure to withdraw from Arab areas. This month, a lightning offensive by his government forces led to the seizure of two Kurdish-held neighbourhoods in the city of Aleppo, quickly followed by the two large provincial capitals of Raqqa and Deir al-Zour. The Syrian Kurds badly misjudged the support that they thought they would receive from their longtime US ally, who instead said that Washington's partner in fighting the Islamic State is now the Damascus government. For the Syrian Kurds, the US position is a painful betrayal after years spent fighting and dying in the fight against ISIS. Isolated and weakened, Kurds must now weigh up an ultimatum from Damascus to integrate peacefully or face yet more force. The desire for unified Syria violently colliding with hopes for Kurdish independence. For RT World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Damascus.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.